Kia ora, hello and welcome to today's Weather Training Teleclass lecture. My name is Jane Barnett and it gives me great pleasure to introduce today's lecture, which has been generously sponsored by BD. Those of you who've listened to Weather Training lectures before will know that it relies heavily on the work of volunteers across the globe, as well as corporate sponsorship to make the education both accessible and affordable. I know that there's many of you listening in today, hopefully from New Zealand, as we were due to hold our annual general meeting today, although unfortunately due to poor weather conditions across large parts of New Zealand, this has had to be postponed. However, it takes more than snow to postpone a weather teleclass, although earthquakes have certainly done it in the past. And it's at times like this I'm very grateful that our speaker is in Hong Kong and not in Canterbury. Today's speaker is well-known name to those of us who work in infection prevention, so we're delighted to welcome him back once again to contribute to the South Pacific Teleclass series. It's hard to do justice to a person with such impressive credentials, as even his brief biography runs to several pages. Professor Sito holds a number of high-profile roles in the field of infection prevention, both in Hong Kong and for the World Health Organization. He is Honorary Professor at the University of Hong Kong and has played a key role in the establishment of local training courses for infection prevention practitioners, as well as being involved extensively in education throughout China and the region. He is the founding president of the Asia-Pacific Society of Infection Control, and besides being Honorary Professor for the University of Hong Kong and the Hong Kong Polytechnic University, he's also a visiting professor for the University of New South Wales. He's authored over 100 research papers, including the book Infection Control for Asian Healthcare Worker, and is a renowned speaker at international conferences. Recently, he's become active in the field of quality healthcare management and is presently the president of the Asia-Pacific Society of Quality Healthcare. Professor Sito, welcome and thank you so much for taking time to contribute to today's lecture entitled The Mask in Infection Control, Understanding the Issues for Appropriate Practice. Over to you.
Yes, thank you very much. Thank you very much, Jane. And let me say it's a pleasure for me to be involved in this series because we who work in infection control know so well that education is so important and so pivotal in our practice. Well, special greetings to those in New Zealand. We read about your snow and it may be difficult, but you know, some of us here in Hong Kong would like to see snow. And in fact, maybe we are a little envious of you since you have snow in New Zealand. But anyway, back to our topics. And it is so heartwarming that infection control really needs international collaboration. We've got to work together because practices are similar and obviously the bacteria and viruses are similar. So today our topic is the mask in infection control. Now what I want to do is to not only talk about the mask, but then to bring in actual debate and controversy in the recent pandemic. And then also I'll end up by a paper that we published recently in the Clinical Infectious Disease on data from Hong Kong. And hopefully we'll wrap up and come up with some pretty good conclusions. Now, I hope it won't be too technical. I've made it very simple so that we all can join in and discuss and maybe even have some debate. Now, PPE, that's my first slide. And really, just to go through the first few slides, it's a usual thing. Of course, mask is one of the personal protective equipment. And as defined here, there's a definition here which is just so that we all know where we are and are starting on the same page. Now, what is important really is not the next slide, which obviously the reason for use is to lower risk, but more importantly, the next slide. Now, what is important to really appreciate, I'm sure all of us do, is that PPE is never 100% guaranteed. So that is why in infection control, when we come to isolation prevention, we don't just speak of PPE, we also speak of administrative control, whereby we make sure that policies are in place to early diagnose the infections, make sure that things are arranged, the physical facilities are in place, and then we also speak of engineering control, whereby the isolation rooms are made available, the right kind, the proper kind, and all these are maybe even more important, but maybe more important is not the right word. All three are important: administrative controls, engineering controls, and then, in spite of these two controls, we healthcare workers have to put on PPE. But we must never assume that once we put on the PPE, it is 100% guaranteed. I'm sure we all know that. This is just as an introduction. But once we use PPE, it must be properly used. And just a few cartoons to lighten things up. You know, obviously, not like this. Or these are actual pictures we took in Hong Kong during SARS. Overreaction. Now, I think we don't want to underuse PPE, but obviously, if you take a look at this, this is not going to work, you know. Look at the second slide. This lady covered herself completely. It just doesn't mean she's protected. In fact, I may say it's even dangerous, all right? So, to understand the mask, today we'll just focus on the mask. We just need to quickly review that right now, the mode of transmission is four big categories: airborne, droplets, contact, and bloodborne, which is shown in the next slide. Now, for the mask, we will not focus on the bloodborne, which basically we use what we call standard precautions. But for airborne, droplets, and contact, we will have to use the mask. And in particular, is that for airborne, as shown in this slide, we will need to use what we call the N95, which I'm sure you all know. But for droplets and contact, we use a surgical mask. Now, so going on to the next slide, this is the basis of airborne transmission. You see, because when we have airborne transmission, as you all know, we cough out things from our lungs, infectious particles from our lungs, and for airborne, it must be less than 5 or some put 3 microns. Anyway, it must be small enough, we cannot see it, small enough to float in the air, and therefore goes for long distance. Once it's bigger, more than 5 micron, it will not float in the air. It will just drop onto the floor. All right? And right now, we still want to use the term 1 meter. All right? That means within 1 meter, it will drop into the floor. And it will not float or fly for long distance. Now, look at this slide. At the moment, there are only three common diseases that we think is airborne: pulmonary TB, measles, and chickenpox. Now, perhaps just to explain further based on this context, therefore, for droplets, and if you need a mask in contact precaution, therefore, we just need the surgical mask. But for airborne precautions, then we need the N95. Now, so even though there are many kinds of masks we use in healthcare, this for infection control, these are the two main categories, all right? We have the surgical mask. When it's not airborne, the surgical mask is mainly as a barrier, as a protection. It doesn't filter the air. It just acts as a shield. And when it's droplets precaution, we need to put on the surgical mask when we come within 3 feet of the infected patient. Now, but for airborne precaution, then we need what we call here the N95 or the respirator. And this doesn't just act as a shield. It acts as a filter. So the air, when we breathe air in through the N95, the air is filtered through an acceptor filter. Now, go on to the next slide. Based on what we just discussed, so let's try to then discuss the issue. And it's more interesting to discuss the issue under real contextual situation. And what better to do than to use the recent H1N1 pandemic. Now, in the recent H1N1 pandemic, and even really before that, there was a lot of controversy. What is airborne? Is influenza airborne? Now, this is quite important. In fact, I would submit to you that a review has been made very extensively, and I would recommend for you Braxton et al., which has reviewed over 2,000 over citations. We have no time to go through this, but in gist, this review clearly documents that for influenza, it is not airborne. And now look at the next slide. You see, the issue is this. It's quite important to understand this concept because there are many misunderstandings making many people think. Many people over-define, over-include diseases and consider them airborne. Now, let me show you this slide from Sahel, 1985. You see, previously, we used to believe that when the lung is infected, we cough, right? And when we cough into the air, obviously. So, in this slide in 1985, it includes almost all the infection, both viral and bacterial, that infects the lung. Because once we have infection in the lung, we cough. It goes into the air. So, it's airborne. But let me just show you the next slide. Here you can see two histopathology slides. One is the normal lung, as you can see, very clean, lots of space. And then we have pneumonia, right? Look at the lung when we have pneumonia. It is soaked wet with fluids and secretion, all right? So it is like wet mud. Now, can I submit to you that, look at the next slide. When we have aerosol, they are very, very small particles, less than 3 to 5 micron. It looks like smoke, really. So take a look at this slide. I put an arrow there. That's how aerosol is. Now, but when you have pneumonia, your lung is soaked wet with secretions. It's like wet mud. So when you cough, what happens? It's more large droplets. And we call this droplets infection. All right? So it should be... this should be clearly understood, and for this reason, therefore, we now classify almost all our chest infection as droplets transmission. And only three, as I mentioned previously, TB, and by the way, TB, often as you know, their abscess is not really wet. It can be pretty dry, you know. And chickenpox and measles. And often the chickenpox and measles issue is because they also infect the skin very extensively, and not just the lung. But these three conditions is classified as airborne because they are actual clinical experiences and reports that they do transmit long distances. All right? Now, so this is how we classify the different type of airborne transmission now. Obligate, the next slide, obligate is TB. Preferential is chickenpox and measles. They may not necessarily be airborne, but they can certainly be transmitted this way. And therefore, both for obligate and preferential, we should take what we call airborne precautions. Now, the last one, opportunistic. They usually don't transmit by the airborne route because, as I said, the lung is soaked wet with secretion. But when you do what we call high-risk aerosol procedures, for instance, very simple, you intubate the patient, you put a tube into the lung, then all the protective mechanism is no more functioning because now a tube directly enters the lung. Then aerosol may be produced. And only when you're doing such high-risk procedures, such as intubation, for the other lung infection, do you need to take what we call airborne precautions? Now, a very central part of airborne precaution, as you all know, but let me just stress it now, is you use the N95 respirator and not the surgical mask or medical mask and so on. Now, next slide, just to let you know that there is this guideline in the WHO website. I just show you because you can just search the WHO website. Very interesting, telling you how you can, even if you have not enough finances to build expensive negative pressure room, you can just open your windows in the right way. But more importantly for this present talk, when we set this guideline up, we did a very thorough systematic review in 2008. We searched all the literature. And this systematic review by WHO just confirmed those points I just made, that for obligate and preferential airborne, after searching all the literature, is pulmonary TB, measles, and chickenpox. Then for opportunistic airborne, you know, only when you do aerosol generating procedures, yes, SARS is possible, and yes, influenza. Now for the others, like adenovirus, RSV, in fact, there is no evidence that it is even opportunistic airborne. Okay? But of course, if you were to intubate a patient with adenovirus infection and you choose to put on an N95, that may not, it's not that you're wrong. You see, you may want to just take extra precautions. But from the literature, only SARS and influenza has evidence that it is opportunistic airborne, or airborne when you do aerosol generating procedures. Now, just again to stress that we did a very thorough systematic review, and this is 2008, before our pandemic. So it was quite fortunate this time, at least for us who are involved with the WHO, that all this is done before the pandemic came upon us. Now, so that is why, now let's look at the issues. That is why when the pandemic came, we who are collaborating with the WHO and with many partners in the world are quite sure, because we are quite confident. We have reviewed everything. So in 2009, April, when the pandemic get upgraded, straight away the WHO is able to say this. The next slide. Human-to-human transmission of H1N1 is primarily through droplets, you see. So I hope you understand now. It was not a sort of a flippant statement. We did many, many hours of work and are quite confident when we stated this, you know, in the guidelines on the website. Okay, now, so what is the isolation precaution needed? The next slide. You know, obviously, we don't want to overreact, as I show in this cartoon. And in fact, 2007, and if you have not downloaded this guideline from the WHO, I would really recommend it. The address is given there. And by the way, we are going to upgrade and sort of update this guideline very soon. But most of the things that are in this 2007 guideline is still valid. So download it for your use. Now, so even in 2007, in this guideline, there's a table called Table 1. The next slide, you can see me framing in red. Now, this is before the pandemic. It is already clearly stated in this guideline, in this table, that influenza, example, if you take a look on the top, seasonal and also pandemic, even in 2007, we have strongly concluded that if a pandemic comes, influenza pandemic, all you need is standard, as you see at the bottom, plus droplets precaution, and not airborne precaution, all right? Now, so just to get us involved in this controversy, because we are discussing issues, let's briefly discuss the USA position. Now, when the pandemic starts, and now it is around May, I'm sure you all know Shea is the American Epidemiologist Association, very good association, very good society. And at the start in May, both Shea and the CDC of the United States states that because it's a new influenza pandemic, they are not very sure. And they cannot say categorically that it is purely droplets. It may be airborne. And that is why in May, the CDC recommends N95. Although from the beginning, the WHO in April already says it is droplets. Now, but very soon, June, just a month after, June 2009, let me quote what Shea then says. The next slide, Shea already says, available data and clinical experiences suggest that H1N1 behaves just like seasonal influenza. So therefore, Shea's endorsed the same practices as seasonal influenza. Now, very important, the bottom phrase. So negative pressure rooms are not needed. Very important, the N95 is not recommended. All right? So the next slide, they even list what are the high-risk aerosol generating procedures in which you may need the N95. Now, so this is a quick summary table, very simple, this table. So WHO and Shea, in fact, look at the last row. Look at the last column. The big point is in the last column. So WHO and Shea only recommends N95 for the aerosol-generating procedures. But the CDC, in fact, believes that you must use the N95 both for isolation and for all activities. Now, interestingly enough, July. Now it comes to July. I'm sure you all know and heard about the HPAC committee. The HPAC committee actually is the advisory committee for the CDC. Interestingly enough, in July, that is 1 month after Shea made the statement, the HPAC then, this is downloaded from their website. They clearly say that no studies to date demonstrate that it's airborne. And they also comment on a study by Blackberry. Now, this is quite important. Blackberry basically shows that there seems to be a lot of virus, influenza virus, spreading widely, a bit like airborne transmission, small particles. But as HPIC committee pointed out, the Blackberry study need to be taken. You know, we must cautiously evaluate this data because it is PCR. And PCR does not differentiate between dead viruses and live viruses. So the significance of this finding needs further investigation. Now, keep this Blackberry study in mind. Because HPIC did come up, mentioned that this study needs to be cautiously accepted, but they recommend quite clearly, the next slide. In fact, again, this is at that time from the CDC website, just surgical masks. And the N95 is basically only for high-risk procedure. Look at the bottom of the slide. And the comment on Blackberry study is PCR positive is not the same as culture positive. Now, so again, quickly summarizing, so Shea, CDC HPIC, and WHRD then basically list their aerosol generating procedures. Now, this is where at that time all three are in agreement. For aerosol generating procedures, yes, it needs to be taken as airborne possible, and the N95 is needed. Now, then in 2009 September, the Institute of Medicine from the U.S. came out with their report. And they strongly say that you need the N95, as stated here. That for H1N1, you should use fit-tested N95. Now, they used two studies to support their findings. Number one, Blackberry study, all right, which the HPIC and others have taken cautiously because it is PCR. It doesn't measure live viruses. Then there's also another study by McIntyre done in China that seems to suggest that airborne of influenza is possible. Now, the McIntyre study has not been published yet. It just appeared in abstract form. And interestingly enough, the IOM used the data and not other published data that shows that really there's no evidence that influenza is airborne. Now, so on let's look at this summary again. Again, look at the last column. So WHO and Shea, N95 only for aerosol generating procedures. Now the CDC with the IOM says that you should just use the N95 for all patient care activities in influenza. All right, now then there come a bombshell. The big meeting of the Infectious Disease Society of America in Florida. In that meeting, McIntyre withdrew, her study. And in fact, McIntyre's study has now been published, and just similar to all the other findings, she now says that there's no evidence that influenza is airborne. But this is reported, as I show here in the slide, ABC News. All right, go to the slide. You can see that the flu mask decision based on McIntyre's study, and McIntyre has sort of retracted her study. Okay, now, so based on all this, Shea, IDSA, and APIC wrote a letter to President Obama saying that you really don't need the N95 and the U.S. policy should be re-evaluated. Now, fortunately, for the WHO, we have not changed the stand right from the beginning to the end. The WHO policy clearly states that it is dropless precaution, standard and dropless precaution, and that for general procedures, all you need is the surgical mask or medical mask. Then after the pandemic in June 2010, the CDC finally, publicly, after much consultation, changed their policy, and now we are all united that for influenza, all you need is a face mask. N95, the next slide, N95 for higher levels is only needed for aerosol-generating procedures. All right? Now, let's go on to the next slide. So, I hope using practical issues, we understand now some of the controversies. But I've just summarized for you that basically, there are only three airborne diseases that we face generally, and the others, all we need is the surgical mask, unless it's aerosol-generating procedures. Now, but there are other controversies too, and we have a little time, so we quickly go through it. Now, it must be appreciated, and I'm sure you all know, that today our talk is on masks for infection control. But the mask, even in the hospital context, is not only used for infection. For instance, in the lab, we use it when there are chemicals that are toxic, where there are chemicals accidents, and even in healthcare, under terrorist attack, we may have to wear masks to prevent toxins. And that's why in the next slide, I show you this triangle that is not just infection, but occupational health and safety are involved. And because of this, there are some controversies, all right? Because sometimes occupational health and infectious disease people, we don't exactly think on the same page or the same line, but things happen all the time, and since we are now giving an infection control talk and we are all in the infection control collaborative work and network and team and family, let's review some of these issues, all right? Now, first of all, respirator, there are many types, and I will want to go to it. We talk about N95. I just want to have a few slides showing you that there are more types, and these are important. More from the occupational health point of view, because, as I said, their interest and concern goes beyond infection. So there are two main types as shown here, air purifying, okay, whereby it really purifies the air that you breathe in. But then the other type, which is mainly our concern, is to provide fresh air from an external source. Okay, now, again, just a few slides showing, for instance, just an example. There are masks like this that you may want to use in a hospital because they are, HEPA filter. They filter more than an N95. In fact, the filter is 99.97. Now, we won't go into this because this, for infection control, we really don't need such HEPA filter. Now, what we need is just this, negative pressure respirator. That is the key of N95. In the N95, we breathe so that it becomes negative under the mask. The mask must be well sealed to our face so that when we breathe, we create a negative pressure environment inside the mask, and therefore air comes in through the N95 filter. And so that's it. This is the N95. We use it all the time. Some call it dust mask because when it was first made, some of these masks are also to remove dust and to filter it from the air. So this is the basic mask we use for infection control. And usually this level is enough. There are many others. Next slide, which I will not go into, but generally for infection control, we don't need this, all right? So the next mask and also others like this for respiratory protection, all we need is the usual N95. Now, so let's go on to the slide now that talks about respirator program elements, all right? Now, you must understand that when the occupational health people frame such respirator program, you should appreciate that it is made with all these other respirators in mind, not just for infection control. And so their program is very comprehensive, and as you can see in this list, there are many things, selection and so on, but the big thing that they include in is fit testing. Because in the general context of these respirators, they not only filter up bacterial or viral particles, they are also concerned about toxins, chemical toxins and chemical fumes. And so the fit is very important, all right? So with this, they devise fit testing, whereby to make sure that the fit fits well, so well that it doesn't allow other air to sort of slip in from the side of the mask and only through the mask. Now, so you should understand that this fit testing sort of whole activities is formulated under the whole spectrum of the different type of respirator. Now that we understand this, it's very easy. The next slide shows you what fit testing would do. And then the next slide is to start focusing on the two types of fit tests, basically qualitative and quantitative. Now, go on to the next slide. It summarizes this, the qualitative test and the quantitative test. Now, very quickly, the next slide just tells you the different protocol. And again, the qualitative and the quantitative, we won't go into that. More the next slide to show you the picture. So this is the qualitative. Basically, we use the sense that the staff has. And it's much better to do the quantitative test. And in fact, these machines are often not affordable. I recommend that if you do fit testing, do the quantitative. Now, but more importantly, now that let's refocus on infection alone. If it is for infection alone, is N95 fit testing required? Now, so I borrow a slide from Bill Jarvis, who previously worked in the CDC for 25 over years himself. And this is what he says. Most elements of the NIOSH respirator program are theoretical using mathematical models and have not been confirmed in practical work situations. In one NIOSH study, fit testing respirator assigned errors were as high as 20%. Now, what he's saying is the fit testing that is formulated and devised by the whole occupational health sort of team and field is very much theoretical when it comes to infection. Okay? And in fact, there are two studies I'm going to quote now that shows you, as far as infection is concerned, the fit testing probably is not needed. One study, as shown here, the next one, Shea abstract, very simple. They just repeat the study. Okay, there are 58 staff who are fit tested, and 3 months later, they did it again and find that there's no correlation. All right, whether you fit test before and after, it makes no difference. Now, there's another study published in Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology, 1996. Again, very simple study. Group A, B, C. I show you the table. Now, it's quite simple, this study. Group A, they did everything as recommended. They fit test and they train. And as you can see, finally, when they sort of really do the test, the fit testing, 94% passed. Now, Group B, they did not pre-fit test, only train, only teach, tell them what to do, how to wear the mask, and they have a 91% passing rate when they finally did the test. The 91 passing rate and the 94 passing rate has no statistical significance. Now, look at Group C. Group C, no training. And sure enough, only 79% pass the test. Now, what this study really concludes, and I think is very logical, that what is important is training. If your training is good enough, the fit test don't seem to have any added value. Now, in fact, this is very much among us infection control personnel who works for many years. This is our thinking. Because, look, you do an annual fit test, and for the rest of the year, when you fit test, you sit in the room, but when you go out, you work. You know, you talk, you carry stuff, your mask obviously move. If it's that dangerous, then we would have been infected anyway. So that is why it's more important to make sure we do every time you put on the mask to do what we call a seal check to make sure that everything fits well rather than doing the annual fit test. All right? And in fact, back to this 2007 document. Please take a look. Download it. Page 44. This is what it says. And by the way, if you look at this document, there are pictures and diagrams, and there are also very clear instructions of how to do what we call the seal check. Now, let me read this now, page 44 in this slide. The fit and seal of disposable particulate respirators is important for effective function. So we are talking about the seal check, which you should be doing every time you put on your N95. The application of fit testing to improve healthcare workers' ability to comply with adequate use of respirator has been evaluated and has not been shown to be an effective means to improve compliance. Now, in fact, let me also point to you that in 2005, in fact, the IDSA wrote again a letter to the CDC saying that they disagree, you know, with the initial and periodic fit testing because there's no sound evidence. Now, so conclusion, and in fact, I did not put his name down. Again, this slide I took from Jarvis. Fit testing of N95 respirator is required in the U.S. because of legal requirements and not scientific data. Dust mist and dust mist fume respirator protect healthcare workers from MTB without fit testing. Third bullet point, there are no data that healthcare workers are at greater risk of infection if they wear a respirator properly that has not been fit tested. Fourth bullet point, data shows that healthcare workers were protected from SARS by N95 respirator without fit testing. Last bullet point, no study has been done to document either the added protection or the cost efficacy of fit testing in the respiratory protection of healthcare workers from infectious pathogens. All right? Now, I myself fully subscribe to these conclusions. And in fact, if you follow these procedures, it will lead to much cost saving and also time. Now, finally, to close the talk, can I draw your attention to this paper that just came out in the Clinical Infectious Disease? In fact, I have sort of put the front page there. You can take a look. And we have collected this data. Now, the gist of this paper is just to show to you in Hong Kong, Hong Kong basically adopted the WHO pandemic guidelines. Almost all aspects of it. In fact, every aspect of it. And does it work? Well, this is this paper, this report in the CID, or Clinical Infectious Disease, sort of give you the results. Now, before we look at this paper, let's look at what has been published. Can infection control, can good infection control practices ensure that influenza prevention works? Now, before we publish our paper, there are two papers already out. In fact, one is in 2010 in Infection Control and Hospital Epidemiology, and the other is in the CID also. Okay? Now, one is published, a study from Saudi Arabia that shows that in their institute, clinical staff has a much higher, in fact, here 6%, clinical staff has a much higher infection rate than non-clinical staff. 6% versus 4.3%. Now, in fact, their population is not small. It's 526. But in their study, it also states, and I quote directly from the study, that infection control personnel were overstretched throughout the study. In other words, the study admits that infection control may not be optimally done. But they do show that clinical staff who come in contact with patients has a much higher rate than non-clinical staff. Now, the next paper is published by the CDC. You see, during the pandemic, the CDC has reports from all over the United States of healthcare workers or hospital workers who are infected. And altogether, they have 70 self-infected healthcare workers reporting to them, and most of them are clinical staff. So it does seem to give a picture that clinical staff who come in contact with patients during the pandemic has higher risk. But of course, even in this paper, the authors from the CDC admits that there is vast underreporting. Of course, the whole of the United States, only 70, you know. And also, for those who report to the CDC, even for these 70, only 20% report using masks during encounter. And so, really, this study and also the study I mentioned previously doesn't answer clearly the question. Does good infection control practices work? Now, this is the WHO guidelines for the pandemic, which we use in Hong Kong, okay? And so, let me tell you about our Hong Kong study. In our Hong Kong study, when the pandemic came, from mid-June to August, in our public hospitals, which covers more than 90% of our patient care beds, we have a system of mandatory reporting. It's very simple. All staff with influenza-like illness must report to the hospital. And when they report, they get free testing. And not only that, they get a week's leave, which can only be granted after the report. And for every staff that report during this period, the infection control nurse would survey them, getting details. Okay? Now, it was quite thorough, and I don't think we missed any cases, really. If you get influenza-like illness, you go to work, your boss would tell you, hey, you should be reporting. So I don't see how any staff can, you know, hide influenza-like illness during those periods. Especially, you know, Hong Kong was really sort of on the alert because of the previous SARS experience. And also getting that 1 week's leave. If you don't report, you're not going to get that 1 week's leave. So I think our data was really very complete. Now, so quickly look at the results. So for 2 months, we have all the data for non-clinical and clinical staff, as shown here. Now look at the next slide, as shown here. Non-clinical means those who don't see patients, the clerks, the administrators, And clinical means they see patients. Now, they may work in the office, but if they see patients, they're included in the clinical staff. Now, take a look. During the mandatory reporting period, in fact, the non-clinical infection rate and the clinical is exactly the same, 0.63%, okay? Now, under B, that's at the end of the pandemic. Of course, more staff will be infected then, but we do not have the non-clinical data because after 2 months, we find it too heavy. And since the non-clinical staff are not getting that much infection, we stop the mandatory for the non-clinical and only for the clinical. Now, at the end, the clinical staff infection rate is 2.6% in Hong Kong. And by the way, we did serology study and found that for the same age group, it is 3.6%. So our clinical staff is no higher for those in the same age group for the general population. Now, let's take a look at the other slide. This compares still the non-clinical and the clinical. And we find that they're very similar. The percentage of contact with family who has the flu, friends who have the flu, and so on is very similar. Of course, why not? You see, why not? If infection control practices works where you work in a hospital, then outside the hospital, it should be the same. Now, the next slide is important. In fact, during the pandemic, the greatest risk for both non-clinical and clinical to get the H1N1 is unprotected exposure to a case. There is a colleague who comes to work, who got the flu, and still comes to work. And they don't wear masks, as you know, because they're coming to work in the office. And therefore, both for the clinical and non-clinical, this is by far the biggest risk. In fact, one lesson we can learn is if the pandemic comes again, just make sure people who have symptoms don't come to work. Now, interestingly enough, as you can see here, is 7.6 and 8.4%. While only 2.5% of our infected staff feels that they get it from patient care. So really, you know, in Hong Kong, very, very few of our staff get their flu from patient care. And almost most of this, in fact, almost most of it is through unprotected exposure. All right? Now, why unprotected exposure is because sometimes, and in fact, quite a number of those cases is exposure to relative of an index case. And they didn't know yet, so they talked to the mother or the father of the index case, and then later on, discovered that the father and mother is also infected. You know, so that happens. Okay, now, to show that our data is accurate, we also did serology on the same population. And as shown here, this is published in another paper, that the serology for non-clinical and clinical is also statistically comparable, 14% and 12%. So verifying that our data collection in the previous paper is pretty accurate. Now, so yes, our clinical and non-clinical staff come out to about the same, exactly the same, in fact. But what is our infection control practices? Well, we think it's pretty good. Look at our hand hygiene. Data collected during that time, close to 70%. And we have just-in-time education session attended by 39,000 of our staff. All right? Now, of course, we have close to 50 over 1,000 staff in the whole organization. So it's not 100%, but it's a pretty high percentage. And in our survey, this is just to show you, look at the last column, the clinical. Most of them just use a surgical mask. Correct. It is droplets and standard precaution. You only use the N95, the face shield, eye shield, glove, and so on, only when required, not routinely. So our survey suggests that they got it. Now, although in our non-clinical staff, many of them still wear surgical masks. And obviously, you know, they are not the ones who went to our educational sessions. at least not all of them. But look at our clinical. The data here suggests that they do understand infection control practices. Okay, that's about all. Now, just the last few slides to show you, don't use this mask wrongly, for goodness sake. You know, don't use it as eye patches or, you know, use it for pets. And just the last cartoon, you know, obviously you don't use it for this statue out in Easter Island. Take a look, he says, you got to stop watching the news, you know. But anyway, I hope this talk helps to clarify and help you to understand in an involved way, I hope, some of the real issues, and that you can now then go off. And really, the mask works. Just use it properly. And yes, have a good day. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Professor Sito. I think you've covered some really key issues for us in infection prevention, with the flu and mask choice issue being really significant for those of us that were tackling that in 2009. And part of that debate, of course, was the difficulties with that lack of clarity in terms of the guidance. And the fit testing issue is significant, especially for countries that might be struggling with the costs associated with all that fit testing. And I think your study overview of the infection rates between clinical and non-clinical has really highlighted the importance of that key education. So I really value the information that you provided for us today. I won't be able to open the lines for questions to listeners, but if you do wish to pose a question to Professor Sito about any of the topics that he's covered today, please don't hesitate to email me using the email address on your slides at Weber Training, and I'll certainly forward that on. Just in closing, I'd like to thank once again Professor Sito for his excellent insight into some of those really important infection prevention issues. I think many of us will go back and listen again to elements of today's lecture and look at some of those slides again, because I think that's a really valuable contribution to the Weber Training teleclass program. I'd also like to again acknowledge BD for their kind sponsorship of today's lecture, and thank them for their contribution once again to Weber Training. And of course to Paul Weber for his tireless effort, time and energy to make these teleclasses happen, and for all his help in setting up today's lecture broadcast from New Zealand. The next couple of slides on your PowerPoint cover the Infection Control New Zealand Infection Control website, some information there for listeners if you'd like to access that, and also the next few Weber Training teleclasses, which take us through to September. So as always, you can access any of those via the website. Our next South Pacific teleclass takes place on October the 26th, when we hope to bring you Dr. Ramon Pink's insights into the public health issues after the Canterbury earthquake disaster. Many of you will recall that this broadcast was postponed due to the subsequent earthquake in February of this year, and remains, of course, a subject very close to our hearts here in Christchurch. So I look forward to talking to you again in October. And until then, goodbye from all of us here in New Zealand. Thank you for joining us.